A father asks his three daughters to prove their love in public. Two flatter him extravagantly, the third speaks honestly and loses everything. This simple scenario, recognizable to anyone who's witnessed family dynamics at a holiday dinner, forms the spine of Shakespeare's most devastating work. But King Lear isn't just about one dysfunctional family. It's about the terrifying moment when the powerful realize they've mistaken performance for truce, when parents discover they've nurtured their own destroyers, and when society's carefully maintained illusions collapse to reveal the chaos beneath. Picture a retirement party where the boss demands his employees publicly declare their devotion before receiving their severance packages. Now imagine the entire company depends on getting this ceremony right. That's essentially what Lear orchestrates in the play's opening scene, except the stakes are a kingdom and the employees are his daughters. Goneril and Regan understand the game perfectly. They deliver Oscar-worthy performances, claiming their love exceeds eyesight, space, and liberty. These aren't just compliments, they're calculated investments. Like corporate climbers who've mastered the language of quarterly reports, they know that in their father's court, extravagant language purchases real estate. Then comes Cordelia with her devastating nothing. Not because she doesn't love her father, but because she refuses to commodify that love. "I love your majesty according to my bond, no more nor less," she explains, a statement of perfect honesty that sounds like coldness to ears trained on flattery. It's the equivalent of responding to, "Do I look fat in this?" with a measured analysis of body mass index. Technically accurate, emotionally catastrophic. Lear's rage reveals something crucial. He's not conducting a love test, but seeking validation. When Kent, his most loyal advisor, tries to intervene, see better, Lear, the king banishes him too. In a single scene, Lear exiles the only two people who genuinely care about him while rewarding two daughters already plotting his downfall. The irony is so painful, it's almost comic. In trying to secure love, he destroys it. In attempting to guarantee his comfort, he ensures his suffering. 400 years after its first performance, this play still cuts deep because it exposes a universal fear that we might not recognize genuine love until we've driven it away forever. Edmund's opening soliloquy, "Thou, nature, art my goddess," reveals how resentment metastasizes into evil. Born illegitimate in a society that brands him inferior, Edmund rejects the entire social contract. Why respect laws that deny him equality? Why honor a father who introduced him as the product of good sport? His villainy isn't motiveless. It's the logical conclusion of lifelong dehumanization. What makes Edmund, Goneril, and Regan chilling isn't their cruelty, but their competence. Edmund forges letters and plays both sisters against each other. The sisters systematically dismantle Lear's dignity, questioning his judgment and gaslighting him about his age. Their cruelty weaponizes reasonable concerns. 100 rowdy nights is disruptive, to justify unreasonable actions. The sexual triangle adds another dimension. Both women desire Edmund because he embodies their new world order. Power trumps propriety, desire overrides duty. When Goneril poisons Regan over Edmund, it's the logical endpoint. If all bonds are breakable, why not break them all? The fool voices what others won't. Lear has made himself ridiculous. Through riddles and songs, he delivers execution-worthy truths disguised as entertainment. "Thou shouldst not have been old till thou hadst been wise," a one-line summary of the entire tragedy. His jokes aren't comic relief, they're survival mechanisms for speaking truth to power. Edgar's poor Tom persona is strategic madness as camouflage. Hunted, he becomes a bedlam beggar, so abject he turns invisible to power. This extreme performance grants him freedom to witness his father's blinding, accompany Lear through madness, and guide Gloucester to redemption, all while hidden in plain sight. Lear's madness is genuine, and it transforms him. In the storm, he simultaneously loses his mind and finds his humanity. "Poor naked wretches, wheresoever you are," he prays, perhaps thinking of homeless people for the first time. Meeting poor Tom, he asks the play's haunting question, is man no more than this? He tears at his clothes, stripping away artificial distinctions between king and beggar. His mock trial of his daughters shows madness as processing. Though detached from reality, the fantasy lets him work through trauma and recognize his own culpability. When Lear stands in the storm shouting, "Blow winds and crack your cheeks," the tempest outside mirrors the chaos inside, his rage, grief, and dawning horror. Shakespeare stages this brilliantly, an old man, powerless and exposed, screaming at forces that don't care. When Lear declares himself a man more sinned against than sinning, he's still making excuses. But when he notices the fool shivering and asks, "How dost, my boy? Art cold?" That's the breakthrough. For the first time, Lear considers someone else's suffering before his own. The hovel scene deepens this shift. Meeting poor Tom, Lear sees humanity stripped bare, unaccommodated man without wealth, status, or shelter. His response is to tear off his own clothes, seeking the same radical honesty. It's both mad and profound. If we're all just poor, bare, forked animals underneath, what justifies the inequalities he's maintained? When the fool disappears after saying, "And I'll go to bed at noon," his last line, it's as if his function is complete. Lear has finally learned what the fool was teaching him. Gloucester's blinding transforms tragedy into horror. Cornwall methodically gouges out his eyes while Regan encourages the brutality. "Out, vile jelly," he shouts, reducing human organs to disgusting matter. Shakespeare refuses to let this violence happen offstage. We must witness it, because physical blinding parallels Lear's psychological destruction. Both men must lose their conventional faculties to gain deeper sight. "I stumbled when I saw," Gloucester realizes, understanding his physical vision had prevented him from seeing his sons clearly. He achieves moral clarity only through literal blindness, a paradox defining the entire play. The horror intensifies through its domesticity. This isn't battlefield violence, but torture in a nobleman's home. Even Cornwall's servant recognizes the moral abomination and draws his sword on his master, a revolutionary act costing him his life. The servants tending Gloucester's wounds with flax and whites of eggs represent persistent human decency, small kindness that doesn't undo the horror, but suggests compassion survives even in darkness. For Edgar, watching his father's torture while disguised as poor Tom creates an impossible dilemma: reveal himself and likely die, or stay hidden and witness his father's agony. His choice to remain concealed while later becoming his father's guide represents love expressed through painful restraint. Dover becomes the play's destination of hope. Edgar, still disguised, guides his blind father there and creates an elaborate fiction at the cliff's edge, describing a vertiginous drop that exists only in language. When Gloucester falls, Edgar's compassionate lie gives his father reason to live. Surviving such a fall must mean the gods want him to endure. Meanwhile, Cordelia returns with the French army, motivated by love rather than conquest. Finding her father wandering mad and crowned with weeds, her response is pure compassion. The reunion scene is almost unbearably tender. Lear, awakening to find Cordelia beside him, thinks he's dead. "Thou art a soul in bliss, but I am bound upon a wheel of fire." His confusion gives way to recognition, then to the humility he lacked earlier. "Pray you now, forget and forgive. I am old and foolish." Both fathers have been humbled and gained insight through the children they wronged. Lear even imagines a future in prison with Cordelia, where they'll sing like birds ith cage, happiness built on love rather than power. For a brief moment, suffering seems to lead to wisdom, but Shakespeare refuses that consolation. The final act systematically destroys every hope the Dover scenes created. Edgar defeats Edmund and reveals his identity. The villains fall quickly. Goneril poisons Regan, then kills herself. Edmund, mortally wounded, tries to revoke his execution order for Lear and Cordelia. For a moment, restoration seems possible. Then Lear enters Carrion Cordelia's body. "Howl, howl, howl, howl," he cries, grief beyond language. Cordelia's death isn't poetic justice, it's bad timing. Edmund's order came too late. She dies because the universe doesn't care about virtue. Lear holds a feather to her lips, desperate to detect breath. This feather stirs. She lives. The man who began demanding elaborate love declarations dies believing his genuinely loving daughter might still breathe. King Lear refuses to comfort us with meaning. Lear gains profound insight, recognizing his neglect of the poor, learning humility, understanding genuine love, but that wisdom can't save Cordelia. The play forces us to confront the possibility that the universe is indifferent to virtue, that good people suffer without purpose, that wisdom extracted from pain might be worthless. Cordelia's death isn't a lesson, it's a refusal of lessons. Yet the play's bleakness contains strange power. By stripping away illusions about cosmic justice, Shakespeare challenges us to find meaning in human connection itself, not in what it achieves, but in its simple existence. Cordelia's love doesn't save her father, but it's real. Kent's loyalty doesn't restore order, but it affirms that devotion matters, even when it fails. Maybe that's the wisdom King Lear offers. Not that suffering leads somewhere, but that we endure it together. Not that recognition redeems loss, but that we keep trying to see each other clearly anyway. Not that love conquers all, but that it matters precisely because it can't. In a world offering no guarantees, the choice to love honestly, to remain loyal, to guide each other through storms becomes its own justification.